Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Overground Railroad, the young adult adaptation, The Green Book, and The Roots of Black Travel in America, by Candace Taylor, narrated by Lisa Renee Pitts. Introduction. Are we there yet? Don't you dare say a word. Ron was sitting in the back seat as his father pulled the car to a stop at the side of the road. His father had told him to be quiet before, but this was the first time Ron felt the words sink to the pit of his stomach. Moments later, the sheriff stood over the expensive 1953 Chevy sedan. Where did you get this vehicle? What are you doing here, and who are these people with you? The sheriff asked. Ron's father answered, It's my employer's car. He pointed to his wife, sitting upright and expressionless in the passenger seat. He pretended that she wasn't his wife and said, This is my employer's maid, and that is her son in the back. I'm taking them home. The sheriff took a long, hard look at Ron's mother and then angled his eyes to the back seat. Ron sat tight-lipped, too afraid to turn his head or even take a breath. Where's your hat? The sheriff barked at Ron's dad. Hanging up right behind me in the back seat, officer. The sheriff waved. All right. Move on. As they drove north across the Tennessee border, a sad, eerie silence hung in the air. The jovial conversation they were having right before the sheriff pulled them over had stopped dead. And although there was no discussion about what had just happened, the gravity of the situation was clear. Ron watched Daddy and Mama exchange knowing glances, and then turned his head to look at the unassuming black cap that had been hanging next to him in the back seat ever since he could remember. It wasn't until that moment that he realized why he had never seen his father wearing it. Mama wasn't a maid, and Daddy wasn't a driver. He had a good job with the railroad, and this was their family car. Until that day, Ron never paid attention to that cap, but now he realized that it wasn't just any hat. It was a chauffeur's hat, a ruse, a prop, a lifesaver. This was during the Jim Crow era, from the late 19th century until the mid-20th, when state and local laws enforced racial segregation in the southern states. Although it was prevalent throughout the country. The chauffeur's hat was the perfect cover for every middle-class black man pulled over and harassed by the police. If Ron's father had told the sheriff the truth, that he was driving his own car and that they were a family on vacation, the sheriff wouldn't have believed him. He would have assumed the car was stolen. In the event that the sheriff did believe it was Ron's father's car, the rage and jealousy he might have felt at the thought of a black man owning a nicer car than a police officer might have triggered a beating, torture, or even murder. From that day on, Ron noticed these hats strategically placed like unarmed weapons in the back seat of nearly every black man's car. Standing in the kitchen, more than 50 years later, I listened to Ron's story, stone-faced. Everybody had one, he said, referring to the chauffeur's cap, and you always kept it in the car. Ron Burford was my stepfather, I had known this man for more than 30 years, but this was the first time he had told me anything about the pain of growing up in the Jim Crow South. It's not that he was a quiet man. Ron loved to talk. He could talk for hours. My mom and my sister and I would try to scoot out of the kitchen before he started in on another one of his long Southern yarns, ones that we had heard before. But it wasn't until I started the Green Book Project that he shared these stories with me. I first saw a copy of the Negro Motorist Green Book in 2014, tucked away under glass at the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. It was a travel guide that was published for Black people during the Jim Crow era. Listings in the Green Book blanketed the entire United States, and later editions included Canada, the Virgin Islands, Europe, and Africa. The guide was distributed by mail order, sold by Black-owned businesses, and made available through a savvy media campaign led by Esso gas stations, which operate as ExxonMobil today. It was successful due to word of mouth, but also as a result of an ambitious grassroots operation of a national network of mailmen, led by the guide's creator and fellow postal worker, Victor Hugo Green. This multi-pronged marketing strategy was so effective that by 1962, the Green Book had a circulation of nearly 2 million readers. I'd never known such a thing existed. Right after leaving the Autry, I called my parents in Columbus, Ohio, and asked Ron if he had ever used the Green Book. He said, "I'm not sure. Probably. There were a few Black guides back then." He was right. I discovered there were about a dozen other Black travel guides, but the Green Book was in print for the longest period of time and had the widest readership. Victor Hugo Green, a man with a seventh-grade education, published the first Green Book in Harlem in 1936, and he worked on it until his death in 1960. His wife, Alma, took up the mantle and kept the Green Book going until 1962. What never wavered throughout the life of the Green Book was the courage and security it afforded Black people so they could pack up their cars and go. The Green Book was published during a time when car travel symbolized freedom in America. It was affordable to many people and allowed travel from one coast to the other. But since racial segregation was in full force throughout the country, the open road wasn't open to all. Getting to safe accommodations could be a dangerous, life-threatening proposition. Not only did Black motorists navigate a country with thousands of sundown towns, all white communities that banned Black people from entering the city limits after dark, but they also couldn't eat, sleep, or buy gasoline at many white-owned businesses. Even Coca-Cola vending machines had "white customers only" printed on them. To avoid the humiliation of being denied basic services, many Black motorists were forced to travel with ice coolers, bedding, portable toilets, and full gas cans. When Black motorists picked up a copy of the Green Book, they were greeted by the words, "Just what you have been looking for. Now we can travel without embarrassment." The businesses listed in it were critical sources of refuge along lonely stretches of America's perilously empty roads. Given the violence that Black travelers encountered on the road, the Green Book was an ingenious solution to a horrific problem. Just what you have been looking for. By 1930, Blacks in the United States owned approximately 70,000 small businesses and over the Green Book's nearly 30-year reign, it listed more than 9,500 of these, including hotels, restaurants, gas stations, department stores, tailors, nightclubs, drugstores, hair salons, funeral homes, real estate offices, and even a dude ranch, a ranch converted into a vacation resort. More than 80% of the listings were clustered in traditional African-American neighborhoods such as Harlem, South Central Los Angeles, and Bronzeville in Chicago. The majority were Black-owned, but there were also Black-friendly white-owned establishments such as Macy's, Brooks Brothers, the Drake Hotel in Chicago, the Hotel Bel Air in Los Angeles, and even Disneyland. Intrigued by the Green Book, I wondered how many establishments still existed. So I hit the road, scouting Green Book listings. I drove nearly 40,000 miles on America's two-lane highways, across acres of wide-open plains and deserts, over mountains and along coastlines. I also passed miles of boarded-up buildings in Baltimore, Detroit, Chicago, and Cleveland. After seeing communities decimated by poverty, crime, and destructive government policies, I was bewildered, broken-hearted, and then furious that human beings were living in such inhumane conditions. On the road, I was verbally threatened, chased by dogs, physically lunged at, and nearly physically assaulted. I understood the risks and took things one day at a time. The only moment I really feared for my life was when I was scouting Green Book sites on the south side of Chicago. 53 people had been shot the same weekend I was there. Although I was trained in model mugging, a program of self-defense for women, there would be nothing I could do to stop a stray bullet. On the days I was too nervous to get out of my car to pump gas, or the times when it was too dangerous to stand on the streets to photograph sights, I would think the whole point of the Green Book was to keep Black motorists safe on the road. But it's 80 years later, and I can't find a safe place to use the bathroom. As I crisscrossed the country, the words Victor Green wrote in his introduction to the Green Book rang through my mind. There will be a day sometime in the near future when this guide will not have to be published. That is when we, as a race, will have equal opportunities and privileges in the United States. It will be a great day for us to suspend this publication, for then we can go wherever we please, and without embarrassment. But until that time comes, we shall continue to publish this information for your convenience each year. Despite the overt racism Victor Green must have experienced during his life, when he wrote this introduction, he had reason to be optimistic. Just a few years before he created the Green Book, the concept of the American Dream was born. It was defined by James Truslow Adams in 1931 as a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position. It was an ambitious goal. But Americans from all races, no matter their economic or social standing in society, wanted to believe in the American dream. Remember, there was no established civil rights movement in the 1930s, no Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., so to be a Black business owner during the Jim Crow era was the highest expression of the American dream. I realized I wasn't interested in presenting the Green Book as a historic time capsule. I wanted to show it in the context of this country's ongoing struggle with race and social mobility, because the problems Black Americans face today, like police brutality, homicide, unfair drug sentencing, and mass incarceration, are arguably just as debilitating and deadly as the problems the Green Book helped Black people avoid more than 80 years ago. The Green Book deserves special attention now because our past and current policies shape how not just Black people, but people of all races and gender identities navigate this country. During my research for this book, I learned so much about America just by getting off the interstate and driving through neighborhoods. Photographing Green Book sites gave me a greater understanding of and insight into the guide that I never would have had merely reading it in my office at Harvard University. On the road, I felt the tenor of a bygone era and saw a new cycle of grit and survival along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevards and in the dilapidated houses on dirt roads across the nation. I found strength and resolve in the Green Book buildings that are still standing. Green Book sites range from A-frame houses to simple storefronts to Spanish colonial hotels. Regardless of their stature, these former safe zones are symbols of refuge that redefine sanctuary and the story of race in America. After 3 years of scouting nearly 5,000 Green Book sites, I learned that more than 75% no longer exist, and of those remaining, less than 5% are still in business. That is why it was so important for me to document the ones that are left. In most traditional African-American neighborhoods, Green Book buildings were destroyed in the name of urban renewal, a federal program that gave cities large grants to rebuild their failing downtowns and other urban neighborhoods. Cities could buy and raise blighted areas, often residential neighborhoods, and build new housing as well as pay private developers to create new highways, office buildings, and shopping malls. Many pointed out that the program amounted to Negro removal because of the way it destroyed thriving Black communities. Many of the remaining Green Book sites are in ruins, and others have been leveled or radically modified beyond recognition. While traveling, I ran a tight ship following a mapping system in which I could scout 30 sites a day. Since most of them are gone, there were times when I would drive for days and not find a single one. On the rare occasion when I did find a Green Book listing that was still in business, it towered over the sidewalk like a rare and beautiful force of nature. It's incredible that any business would survive up to 70 years. Given that most Green Book businesses were owned by Black families, to find one that is still operating was reason enough to celebrate. The sites that are still with us symbolize survival. They endure the times the pendulum of equality swung forward and a wrecking ball swung back. Green Book businesses are powerful. They shape the narrative of Black mobility and tell a story that is not all about struggle. These sites of sanctuary symbolize Black ingenuity, resourcefulness, strength, entrepreneurship, and resilience. They carry a cultural memory with them and reveal the untold story of Black travel, offering us a rich opportunity to re-examine America's story of segregation, Black migration, and the rise of the Black leisure traveler. Chapter 1. The Business of the Green Book. Victor Green was on a mission to find the best printer he could, so he headed down to 800 6th Avenue, near 28th Street, in Manhattan's Flower District. He walked past the trash bins filled with fresh-cut flower rejects, entered the building, and rode the service elevator up to the third floor, where the offices of Gibraltar Printing and Publishing Company were located. There, he met Howard Glenner, the 7-year-old son of the print shop's owner. The grown-up Glenner remembered seeing Victor Green for the first time. He was a very tall man, impeccably well-dressed. He was wearing a suit, a tie, and a hat. Gibraltar's was a white-owned print shop, and it was the first time Glenner had seen a black man there. In fact, it was unusual to see a black man in this area of Manhattan at all. Glenner said, "I don't know if he would have been served coffee in the local Greek diner down the street." Green was very distinguished, he remembered. He had a manner about him. Legend has it that Victor Green got the idea to produce a black travel guide from watching his Jewish friend use a similar guide for Jewish people to vacation in the Borscht Belt, an area of resorts in New York State's Catskill Mountains. Green teamed up with a fellow postal worker named George I. Smith to publish the first Green book in 1936. The first edition was small, only 10 pages, but it was a mighty weapon in the face of segregation. After 2 years, Green and Smith parted ways for unknown reasons, but Green's brother, William H. Green, joined Victor and his wife Alma in the project, editing the Green Book until he died in 1945. Producing each Green Book must have required an enormous amount of time and effort, but Victor Green kept his day job as a full-time letter carrier for the U.S. Post Office, commuting from Harlem to Hackensack, New Jersey, 5 days a week. The commute, coupled with the labor of delivering mail in snow, ice, wind, and rain, must have been exhausting. But Green kept the job because it was reliable, stable employment. During his career, he was a member of the National Association of Letter Carriers, a predominantly white union. There was a black postal union, the National Alliance of Postal and Federal Employees, but Victor joined the association. Just as Green had forged a relationship with a white-owned printer, this was highly unusual. Still, his charisma must have won the white union members over, as he stayed with the union for 40 years. After his day job, Green worked nights and weekends on his guide. There were at least 6 other black travel guides on the market while the Green Book was in publication, but none was in print as long as or had the reach and readership of the Green Book. He worked hard to make his stand out. In the 1939, 1940, and 1941 editions, a brand identity emerged, and the Green Book hit its stride with a consistent cover design, feature articles, and a 2-column layout. The 1939 edition included listings for every state except Nevada, New Hampshire, and North Dakota. The cover for the 1948 Green Book features a dapper man wearing a tailored double-breasted coat, a tie, a hat, and 2-toned wingtip shoes. His female companion wears the rounded-toe baby doll pumps that had just hit the stores that year. The houses, trees, and one falling leaf in the background place the couple in a nice suburban neighborhood. Both are carrying suitcases and smiling and decide to look our way in mid-stride en route to their car, to the left of the frame. This couple was so dynamic that their image became part of the logo Green used in following editions and on his business stationery for years. The Green Book's longevity and success stemmed from Victor Green's vision, grit, creativity, and stamina. Like most of the other guides, the Green Book was distributed by mail order and word of mouth. But it was Green's ingenious idea to enlist an army of letter carriers to comb America's streets for advertisers that made the Green Book into one of the most densely packed black and white travel guides on the market. Victor Green's office in Harlem was down the hall from the National Alliance of Postal and Federal Employees, a group of mostly black union mailmen. So he partnered with them and the National Association of Letter Carriers. They took Green Books with them as they delivered mail. And since the Postal Service was segregated, they were mostly assigned to work in black neighborhoods. Many of these postal workers knew the black business owners and encouraged them to advertise in the Green Book. After 1939, the Green Books boasted more than 1,000 listings, and nearly 10,000 businesses were advertised over the life of the guide. Green was determined to make the best product he could. He opened the 1939 edition with a letter announcing that all the businesses listed had been selected with care and were the best and most responsible in their field. For the first couple of editions, Green traveled to personally inspect many of the places listed in the guide, but of course, as it expanded across the eastern United States and then on to the west, there was just too much ground to cover. To remedy this, he asked readers who visited businesses during their travels to please mention the Green Book. Ask them to get in touch with us so that we might list their place. He also wrote, "If this guide has proved useful to you on your trips, let us know. If not, tell us also, as we appreciate your criticisms and ideas for the improvement of this guide from which you benefit." By 1948, Green needed help, so he placed ads seeking full and part-time sales agents to find new businesses to list, inspect properties, and sell subscriptions and advertising space. It was, he assured them, an excellent opportunity to earn extra money on a commission basis that will not interfere with your regular work. Green also looked for people to submit articles about Negro motoring conditions, scenic wonders, places visited of interest, and short stories on one's motoring experience. 24 articles were published over the life of the Green Book. They included personal trips, but also pieces highlighting automobile culture, airline and railroad travel, and the national parks. Others profiled particular U.S. cities such as Denver, Los Angeles, Louisville, New Orleans, New York City, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. The 1939, 1940, and 1941 Green Books were packed to the margins with restaurants, hotels, and a host of other services, all alphabetized by state, city, and type of business. Although collectively it was an impressive list, there were still parts of the country that had few options available. For instance, the Green Book listed only 4 tourist homes in the entire state of Wisconsin. New Mexico and South Dakota listed 2 tourist homes each, and there were only 2 hotels offered in Miami. Green must have found strength from the supporters who stopped in his office to congratulate him, some leaving orders for the next edition. He must have cherished letters such as the one he received from William Smith, a New Jersey resident, who wrote, "It is a great pleasure for me to give credit where credit is due. Many of my friends have joined me in admitting that the Negro Motorist Green Book is a credit to the Negro race. It is a book badly needed among our race since the advance of the motor age. Realizing the only way we knew where and how to reach our pleasure resorts was in a way of speaking by word of mouth until the publication of The Negro Motorist Green Book. We earnestly believe The Negro Motorist Green Book will mean...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?